from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, coming to you this week live from NPR member station WWNO in New Orleans. This week, difficult talks on Syria, an opening to Edward Snowden, and the Russians hunt for black widows in Sochi. On Wednesday in Switzerland, Syrian peace talks began, not peacefully. Syria's Foreign Minister Walid Mualim sparred with UN Chief Ban Ki-moon as he accused the U.S., Turkey, and Saudi Arabia of funding and arming what the Assad regime calls terrorists in Syria.
I have the right to give the Syrian version here in this forum.
Yes, of course, you know, I
do not. After 3 years of suffering, this is my right.
On Saturday in Dagestan, next door to Sochi, Russian government forces killed one black widow, their term for a young Muslim woman terrorist. Russia is hunting for two more, but Lisa Cervantes, the mother of U.S. Olympic speed skater Kyle Carr, said on Thursday that the threats won't keep her away from Sochi.
They're real, but it's if we all said we're not going, we're staying home, they win.
And an arrest in the 1978 Lufthansa Airlines heist in New York, then the single biggest haul in U.S. history, nearly $6 million. Made famous in Martin Scorsese's film Goodfellas, Vincent Ancero was arrested by the FBI on Thursday. Here's the famous scene from Goodfellas.
Nobody knows for sure just how much was taken in the daring pre-dawn raid at the Lufthansa cargo terminal at Kennedy Airport. The FBI says $2 million. Port Authority police say $4 million. The city cops say $5 million. Lufthansa said anything.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Michael Hirsch of National Journal, Stephanie Grace of The Advocate here in New Orleans, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What are you thinking on Syria, Sochi, West Virginia's drinking water, the president's comments on pot? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me today in the studios of WWNO here in New Orleans is Stephanie Grace, columnist for The Advocate of New Orleans. Stephanie Grace, welcome to On Point. Great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for coming in. And joining us from Washington is Michael Hirsch, chief correspondent for National Journal. Michael, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Great to have you, Michael. Holding down the fort in Boston today, On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Michael, and Stephanie.
It's a chilly day here in New Orleans. The other side of Lake Pontchartrain from where we're sitting right now, I understand they have sleet, maybe even a little snow, cold all over the place. Cold as well in Switzerland, Michael Hirsch. At these so-called peace talks on Syria, do you see any kind of movement here, Michael, that might suggest a solution other than arms and blood?
The only movement evident at the moment, Tom, is perhaps out the door. The talks, as far as we can tell, have all but broken down. The Syrian government delegation has said that they may well leave by tomorrow unless there is some movement of any kind whereby the Syrian opposition will agree to meet with them, which they're not now because the Syrian government delegation has not accepted the so-called Geneva One statement, which required that some sort of a transitional government process be set up to replace the regime of Bashar al-Assad. And of course, the Syrian government is saying, no, that's not going to happen. The problem here is that the circumstances have changed dramatically since Geneva One more than a year ago, and the Syrian government under Assad is in a much stronger military position. So there doesn't seem to be very much prospect for anything really happening here.
The tone of Americans at the conference seemed almost as if it was frozen in amber from a year ago. Here was Secretary of State John Kerry calling for this new transitional government in Syria and saying in Switzerland that Syrian President Bashar al-Assad would have to give up his power for there to be peace in Syria.
Bashar al-Assad will not be part of that transition government. There is no way possible in the imagination that the man who has led the brutal response to his own people could regain the legitimacy to govern.
No sign of listening to that line from Syria's Foreign Minister Walid Mualim, saying here that John Kerry had no right to intervene in the internal affairs of his country, interpreted here by CNN.
No one in the world
Mr. Kerry, nobody in the world has the right to get rid of the legitimacy of a president or a constitution or a law or anything in Syria except the Syrian people themselves.
Jack Beatty, what a strange scene. After all this anticipation, all this talk, Kerry has been talking for a long time about this meeting. Here we are, and it all seems to amount to nothing but a lot of vitriol while the killing goes on. These photographs that came out this week of years of terrible torture in Syria and in Switzerland, nothing.
Nothing. It's almost like it's a dumb show. It's a sort of pantomime to ease dormant consciences. And the time frame. You know, Secretary Kerry mentioned the Vietnamese peace talks. He said, well, they went on for years. And a spokesperson for the rebels said, time is blood. So the longer the peace talks go on, quote unquote, or whatever this is, so long as this sort of talk goes on, the longer the killing goes on. And you mentioned these images. There are perhaps as many as 55,000 images of dead prisoners executed, people shot and tortured, come out through a leak from a defector from the Syrian government. This is going to afflict the conscience of the world. But nothing is going to be done. I mean, in terms of intervening, and the idea that this can just run on for years, it's appalling. And the President Obama spoke to Syria in his interview with David Remnick in the New Yorker, and he made the point that people have been saying right all along, and they'll say this weekend, Mr. President, you should have intervened in 2011. Why didn't you? He said that's magical thinking. The idea that we could have put arms and finances, that would have worked. He said, I tasked the CIA to look into that. Is there any track record that that's successful? CIA came back and said there's very little to show that that sort of policy would have worked.
Stephanie Grace with me here in New Orleans today. What about this issue of Syria? The suffering there is tremendous. And we get word after word after word of how bad it is. Now we have all these images. You can actually see it. The refugees are all over the place. But in the great American public, this, I believe, seems far away.
I think it really does, and especially given the economy and given people here, I have to say, everyone's aware of it, of course, mm-hmm. and horrified by it, but it kind of blends in with some of the other things going on in the world, and it does seem very far away.
There was a strange back and forth, Michael Hurst, this week about Iran. Ban Ki-moon of the United Nations inviting them to participate in these Swiss talks in Switzerland, and then very shortly thereafter, disinviting them. What was that all about, Michael?
Well, the question was whether Ban Ki-moon thought that he had at least a provisional concession from the Iranians that they would accept Geneva I. That's always been the precondition set by the Americans that Iran could only attend if they accepted the idea that there should be a transitional government away from the Assad regime. And, of course, Iran has refused to do that because they're an ally of Bashar al-Assad. So after it became clear that Ban Ki-moon was mistaken in his assessment, he was pressured by the Americans mainly to withdraw the invitation. And so, as we saw, the talks were deeply troubled even before they began. And, and there are a few other things going on here that really spell doom, I think, for these talks. It's not just that the military situation on the ground has changed. It's also that Bashar al-Assad has come to an agreement with the United States and Russia on removing his chemical weapons. And so to some degree, he sees himself as a legitimate partner, in this affair. And beyond that, the real – getting back to Jack's description of this as sort of a dumb show or a pantomime, the real military power on the ground in Syria representing the opposition is not even here in Geneva. They are the radical Islamist groups that are currently fighting among themselves. So, the opposition that's appearing there and refusing to talk to the Syrian regime's delegates doesn't even have any power on the ground. And in fact, many even American officials fear that you could have a radical Islamist regime even worse than the Muslim Brotherhood government in Egypt replacing Assad. So there are a lot of doubts that really illustrate how dramatically changed we are from Geneva I here.
I can't help wondering, Stephanie, the stakes here could end up being very high for Americans. I mean, a whole region potentially in disarray. There's talk of region-wide war, even Iran and Saudi and their proxies here. Do you feel any concern in your community, let's say, about American influence here? I mean, these were the talks that when Russia came in and kind of saved the day and got Congress wouldn't go for military action, these were the talks everybody pointed to as the moment at which John Kerry and the U.S. would sort of push the American perspective into the world and, you know, nothing.
Right. You know, I feel like there's a real isolationist sentiment in places like this. That there are these huge problems out there that the United States is involved in, but they don't seem very solvable, and there's certainly not a lot of appetite for active intervention. People here really do keep an eye on the energy industry side of that, because that's a very big industry here, and it kind of fuels the sentiment that we need to step up production and, you know, kind of
here domestically,
Keystone Pipe, you know, like
metal,
take care of ourselves.
Yep,
because look what's happening in the rest of the world. I think it does fuel that very much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're broadcasting live today from member station WWNO in New Orleans and looking at a week in the news. Difficult talks on Syria and opening to Edward Snowden. The president speaks to POT. Former Governor Bob McDonnell and his wife indicted in Virginia. Michael Hirsch is with us, chief correspondent for National Journal, joining us today from Washington. Stephanie Grace with The Advocate here in New Orleans, columnist, is in the studio with me. Jack Beatty is here. Eric Holder this week stepping up to talk about Edward Snowden and raise what seemed to be, Michael Hirsch, the idea of a plea deal here. Does that signal to you that there's something in the works, Michael? Or is this just a wish of the Attorney General, and a wish for what?
I don't think that Eric Holder came to this on his own, with public opinion polls showing increasing support for Edward Snowden's leaks. And increasing opposition to NSA surveillance programs. There's definitely been a shift in the wind, the political wind, if you will, because the Obama administration was saying not too long ago that, you know, there would be absolutely no clemency, there would be no discussion of any kind of an amnesty, and that he would be brought back to be charged. Now, here you have Holder floating the idea that if there is some acknowledgement of wrongdoing by Snowden, a plea deal could be worked out. So that definitely is a break here. Now, from what we know of what Snowden is saying, he's holding firm and in insisting that he, you know, would not come back under these circumstances. But I think what we're seeing here is the beginning of a negotiation.
A negotiation, one wonders where it leads and what's pushing Holder. Here he was on Thursday. This was an appearance at the University of Virginia, suggesting that the DOJ would be open to a plea deal with Edward Snowden if Snowden were willing to plead guilty to criminal charges.
Well, if Mr. Snowden wanted to come back to the United States, enter a plea, we would engage with his lawyers. We'd do that with any defendant. We've always indicated that the notion of clemency was not something that we were willing to consider.
Are you sure, Michael Hirsch, is anybody sure that that or elements of that are really not on the table? They may be very unhappy with Edward Snowden, but he is said to have lots more information that hasn't been released yet. And I wonder, Michael, about his leverage, saying, hey, give me a deal here or you're going to pay month after month, year after year, with more revelations and leaks.
Yeah, I mean, that would be part of the discussion. And certainly those who have been prodding the president to consider clemency, including some national security hawks, say that's why he should, because of the fear of what has to be revealed yet. They've made their stand here. They've said no clemency. President Obama himself, in various remarks he's made over recent months, has said very clearly that he would not consider a pardon or clemency. So, you know, it would be pretty hard for them to backtrack from that position. But, you know, between that position and some kind of negotiation over what criminal penalty Snowden might face, you know, there's a lot of room for maneuvering.
You know,
There's been talk about asylum in Brazil. We've got one listener here. I mean, there are people who are still fiercely angry with him, but others very supportive. Listener says, long live Edward Snowden. May he soon meet the girl from Ipanema. Or Snowden, for director of the new Department of Civil Liberties and Intelligence Oversight, Dianne Feinstein need not apply. Jack, can you imagine a back-channel negotiation going on here? It doesn't have to be clemency. They could put him in some, you know, easygoing, I don't know, prison somewhere for a couple of years and maybe grab back a lot of those leaked documents.
That's very possible. Another possibility is to go to the plea he might make and the defense he might make. In these, he's charged with theft and under two counts of the Espionage Act of 1917, a very controversial act. Only nine cases have been brought under it. This White House has, well, Snowden would be the seventh. I mean, the White House has made a record on these espionage cases. And in Espionage Act cases, the defendant cannot plead intent. For example, Chelsea Manning couldn't say, I did this because the country was doing immoral things and I wanted to show. He couldn't make that plea. That's not allowed. I could imagine some kind of deal with Snowden that would say, all right, you can make the plea of intent. You can say to the jurors, look, there are X number of acts in Congress to change this system that I exposed. There have been four commissions that have looked into this and have said this isn't right. There's been a judge, at least one, who said that it's unconstitutional, this metadata. Obviously, I've done a lot of good things. Yes, I stole something, but isn't that rather trivial next to the good intent I had and the good results my action produced?
Stephanie Grace, here in New Orleans, what about can you imagine the reaction of your, let's say, readers? Mm-hmm. If a deal were seen to have been cut by the government with Edward Snowden, some kind of leniency in return for some kind of shut up and sit down and stop leaking, how do you think that might go down?
Here the conversation I feel like is much less about Edward Snowden than about the Obama administration, which is pretty typical for a place like this.
And what angle?
Very conservative state where there's already a lot of suspicion, talk of big government, and he wants to be in your life. Again, this is among Republicans, but it's a very Republican state.
So this is where be in your life, as in the NSA in your life? Does this mean support for Snowden or not?
Well, indirectly, I guess, but more opposition to the tactics of the government. And I think the conversation is more up there. It more kind of feeds into this idea that many people here already have, that the big government's out of control. And of course, on the Obama's side, no one's really defending them.
That can put a conservative in an awkward position, though, a libertarian anyway, because on the one hand, we've heard Republicans even this week defending the NSA very strongly. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you know, if you're looking into Americans' lives, that's not exactly a libertarian way to go at a certain point.
And when you kind of get down to the individual level, I think you can know intellectually that there are maybe some very valid reasons for this, but in an environment where people are so, I think, uncomfortable and concerned about privacy, online privacy, credit card privacy, the whole ball of wax, not really understanding what is private and what isn't in this current environment, it just feeds into that, I think.
It's strange not to understand that in a country with a constitution like ours. Speaking of looking into people's lives, a big example of that this week with the former governor of Virginia, Bob McDonnell.
Yes.
Here he was on Tuesday. He was flanked by his wife and children responding to charges that he and his wife accepted illegal gifts while in office. McDonnell asserting here he was wrongfully accused.
I come before you this evening as someone who has been falsely and wrongfully accused and whose public service has been wrongfully attacked.
Jack Beatty, what's the litany here, sir?
Well, you know, you'd almost have to go to Bergdorf Goodman's and Saks. And
I need a new dress. I need some money.
I mean,
how about it?
You know, I need a $15,000 to give my daughter a proper reception. I had to borrow. I went to my backers to get my money to pay for the reception. I mean, it's the pettiness of this that makes it so sort of appalling, and on the other hand, so understandable. visible for the public. People look at this and they just say, this is what, you know, this is what they hate about people abusing power. Strangely, in the Commonwealth of Virginia, as I understand it, it's been up to the honor of public officials to turn down gratuities, gifts. There's no law against it in Virginia, apparently. And it was just assumed that Virginia gentlemen didn't do that sort of thing. Well, I think that'll have to change. And Governor McDonald is saying, yeah, so it wasn't illegal in Virginia. And federally, there's here's the quid, the snake oil salesman who was trying to sell various drugs and so on. He gave us a lot of stuff. That's true. We gave a lot of it back. But there's no quo. I didn't give him anything. Well, the federal government says, wait a minute, that's a similar case that Rod Blagojevich made in Illinois. He said, I didn't get anything either.
The Senate seat not
yeah,
given, okay.
Right, right. But that's no defense against, intent to violate the law.
Michael, you're right there on Virginia's doorstep. Is there shock looking here? These charges of fraud, soliciting loans and gifts from Johnny Williams, the CEO of a maker of dietary supplements who was there in the McDonald's state. Does it appear shocking or just surprising that it's come to light with formal legal charges?
I think the indictment was a little bit of a shock, but not very much of one. I mean, there's been a slow drip of revelations about the McDonald's. It's been quite clear for a long time that his political career, this once rising star in the Republican Party, who was even seen as a potential presidential candidate, was in deep trouble because of the investigative reporting. A lot of it in the Washington Post. I do think though that the extent and the nakedness, I would say, of the McDonald's financial needs, particularly as expressed by his wife in these emails that have been revealed in the indictment, are quite startling. It was clear that this was a family that really needed money. And, I think that might create a little bit of sympathy for McDonald if this does go to trial, because here's
a guy
who
clearly asked for a $50,000 loan, right. Though
right.
This is not penis.
Well, the key for the prosecutors is to prove that there was a quid pro quo. They have two problems with that. Was there really any benefit to the company of Johnny Williams, their benefactor, in terms of the political favors that he was supposedly granted? Beyond an event that the governor held at the mansion, we don't really know of any. Second, most of this does seem to be at the behest of his wife. It seemed to be mainly McDonald's wife who was soliciting this aid, and of course she didn't hold elective office. So I do think there's a pretty high bar for the prosecutors to get over here to gain this conviction.
Stephanie, how's this look on a Louisiana yardstick?
Well, this is our thing here, political corruption, although all these other states seem to be giving us a run for our money.
Yeah.
I have to say, somewhat typical. We've been through so many of these cases here in Louisiana. We have another one coming up next week. The former mayor of New Orleans is about to go on trial.
Ray Nagin.
He was the mayor during Hurricane Katrina.
Famously, yeah.
For accepting kickbacks. There's always a variation. It wasn't Oscar de la Renta Gowns. It was Granite in this case, and because his son set up a Granite business and he had a deal with Home Depot that is part of the indictment, and one of the contractors has already pled guilty. Gave him a couple truckloads of Granite. So there's always a little story in there.
But there may be forgiveness in Louisiana as well. I mean, David Vitter, who had his trouble some while ago, now he's running for Senate.
They're very different politicians, yeah. I would say. Ray Nagin really left office very unpopular. And the feeling was he got reelected after. He asked people to give him another chance. And then he immediately tried to set up himself for after he left office and his family. That's really typical. You see that in the McDonald case too. There's this slippery slope, air of entitlement. People are in these environments where there's so much money flowing and they can make so many other people rich.
Yeah.
I think you just kind
Where's
of see it
piece,
over and
taste,
over again.
As Tony Soprano used to say.
Exactly. Now, if this might give the McDonald's some comfort, we had a governor that did go to prison, Edwin Edwards, and he is now out, and he divorced his young wife while he was in prison. He married a younger woman who started writing Tim in prison, and they got a reality show when he got out of prison. So,
I'm not sure
there is life after.
I don't know if the McDonald's are going to take solace in that.
It was
right
canceled
now.
After only a few episodes. It was truly terrible. But we've been through this a lot. Former Congressman Bill Jefferson is actually in prison now. Another case
that was
out of
the freezer with cash.
Exactly. Another cash case. And again, so often it's true that the quid pro quo is the key here, and the defense kind of always makes the argument that the two, you know, the favors weren't connected to any acts. Bill Jefferson specifically argued that the favors were not official acts because they did not involve legislation. What he did was he was very active in Africa, and he basically used his influence, I think, to set up meetings with business people, with leaders in Africa. And he said that was, even though he used official letterhead, people in his office, he said that was not an official act because it wasn't legislation.
But once you've got the quid, there are many ways to deliver the quo.
The jury didn't go for it, obviously.
Jack Meaney, sometimes it's quid pro quo, sometimes it's just bringing the hammer down. Chris Christie with more woe on this pressure front, allegations this week.
Yes, over the weekend, Don Zimmer, the mayor of Hoboken, came out with a pretty explosive charge that the lieutenant governor of New Jersey basically told her in a parking lot in Hoboken, look, you can get the Sandy aid you need and the quantity you need, but you've got to approve this development on a patch of land in Hoboken. It turns out that one of the principals in the development is a very close Christie ally. And now, this was in 2012, I think, well before the re-election of governor, overwhelming re-election of Governor Christie. And the question to Mayor Zimmer was, well, why didn't you bring this forward at the time? And her answer is, well, you know, I'm a mayor. I need stuff from the governor, and I couldn't very well burn all my bridges then. Well, of course, that's more a political issue than a legal one. Legally, she has now three witnesses who have said, yes, at the time she did mention something like this to them. Of course, they're all connected to her one way or another. And she has this diary entry that purports to be, and I guess is, contemporaneous with the event she claims. The lieutenant governor says it wasn't that way at all. She misunderstood. If I said anything even remotely like that, it's clearly been a misunderstanding. So that's where we are on that front. And meanwhile, on the old bridge front, we've got, 20 federal subpoenas went out just in the last couple of days to the Republican committee in Republican Party in New Jersey, and the Christie Reelection Committee, and to a whole roster of principals whose names Bridget Kelly and others have come up in the investigation. So this investigation continues.
Stephanie Grace, throw your New Orleans eye on this one. From Republican quarters in New Orleans, beyond in Louisiana, was there enthusiasm for Chris Christie pre all this? And what about now? Does he look viable somehow, revivable, or like toast?
I think he was pretty popular. I suspect a lot of people here in the state, again, which is very conservative, maybe didn't know some of the details of his political philosophy. I think he is pretty much to the left on some issues compared to people here. I have to say, I saw our governor, Bobby Jindal, the day that this story was breaking, and he seemed to be in a pretty good mood. It's
jolly,
really
a little bit jolly for
a little
Christie's
bit
troubles.
I have to say, there's
because he's ambitious himself,
exactly,
on this front.
And there, you know, there's this big group of Republicans that are, they're all kind of jockeying, looking at the next election, and Bob McDonnell used to be one of them, Chris Christie, Bobby Jindal is one of them. So when, you know, one falls, it creates an opportunity for one of the others.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, broadcasting live today from the studios of WWNO in New Orleans. In other news this week, pop star Justin Bieber was arrested for drag racing on Thursday. Media frenzy. Miami Beach resident Jason Edmonds witnessed the scene.
There was cars going up and down last night in the early hours of the morning, and they weren't going slow. Let's leave it at that.
The Seattle Seahawks and the Denver Broncos are going to the Super Bowl. After their win over the San Francisco 49ers for the NFC Championship, Seahawks cornerback Richard Sherman raised dismay with his let-it-rip trash-talking of 49ers receiver Michael Crabtree.
Well, I'm the best corner in the game. When you try me with a sorry receiver like Crabtree, that's the result you're going to get. Don't you ever talk about me.
Yeesh. And on Monday, the European Space Agency's operations center in Darmstadt, Germany, received a signal from their Rosetta comet chaser. After 31 months of deep space hibernation, it was a great moment as Rosetta came to life. And on to the comet. We're looking at a week in the news, difficult talks on Syria, an opening to Edward Snowden, the president speaks to pot, and former Governor Bob McDonnell and wife indicted in Virginia. And lots of concern this week about what's going on, what's awaiting people in Sochi. The Russians appear to be struggling with this. On Wednesday, Russian Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev spoke to CNN's Christian Amanpour when she asked him about the current hunt for black widows, Muslim terrorist women, the Russians say, in and around Sochi. Medvedev said this, interpreted by CNN.
You know that we are having very, very tough struggle against terrorism. This is the reality of our life of today. And all those threats, including the ones you have mentioned, occur not in the context, not only in the context of the Olympics. Sometimes we have good results, but sometimes we don't have the results we expected.
Have been some very bad results when it comes to terrorism attacks, very tough ones in Russia. Let's go to Paul, calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Paul, thanks for calling. You're on the air. What do you think?
Hey, Tom. I think it's. I was in Sochi a couple years ago when they were setting the site up for the in the area where they're saying set up for skiing and stuff. It was beautiful watching the city just rise up out of the middle of nowhere, and all the work that was going into it. And something that we were talking about at the time was, you know, with Russia's problems, was, is this going to be something they can protect? I think the bigger thing that any terrorist would be trying to do is to scare people away. I think once the games are up and going, it's going to be a lot harder for an attack to actually occur.
We'll see how that works out. I mean, attack, there's been a lot of talk this week about the president trying or talking with the Russians, the U.S. offering equipment and maybe more help than that. The Russians sensitive about taking that, but clearly don't want things to go wrong at the games. Paul's been there. Let's go to Matt in Bradford, Pennsylvania. Matt, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. Just a general fear. I was actually talking to my fiance about this last night. I was watching the Pens play the Islanders, and you know, it just chokes you up a little bit to think that these good athletes, men or women, could suffer from some sort of selfish attack, you know, on, you hear these threats, and it just scares me. It really does. You know, whether it's in a plane or on the playing field, you know, wherever they're at over in Sochi, I'm just nervous for them. I got to be honest.
It's going to be so interesting to watch how American television covers this. You know, on the one hand, NBC comes in and they already have their promotional ads out, and it's all about the Olympic spirit and beauty and sport, which is a great draw. You can't help wondering, though, if they may be tempted to toy with this black widow menace. They're looking for viewership, and I don't want to be too cynical here, but I wonder, Stephanie, if they're going to play up the threat, play down the threat, just stare straight at it?
Boy, I have to think they're going to play it down. It doesn't, you know, the storyline that sells is the glory of the athlete, and obviously it's the sports division versus the news division of NBC.
Yeah. Maybe you're right, but swing those cameras around over the streets. Is there a black widow? Craig in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Craig, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I think the media is doing a giant disservice to the Russian Olympics and the global community, because how would America like it if they were putting on the Olympics and the media showed the bombings in Boston and Oklahoma and 9/11 and talked about all the emails America was receiving? You know, if the Russian Olympics does fail, then maybe one good thing, we could have a global movement to totally eradicate Islamic terrorism from the face of the earth.
Well, good luck with that. Russia has put a lot of effort within its own borders into a version of that for a long time. And they have a lot of deeply disaffected people there. Now, the U.S. has disaffected people as well in its own terror threats. Michael Hirsch, what do you think about the way the American government, the American media, have been responding to the security threat in Russia?
Well, again, I don't think you can blame the messenger here, as in most of these stories, the Russians themselves have been preparing for terrorist acts. You know, you've got this 40,000-person military and police ring of steel, as Vladimir Putin called it, around Sochi. The hunt for the so-called Black Widows, who are widows of allegedly widows of insurgents that have been killed in southern Russia. I mean, this is an ongoing issue. It's not something that the American media made up. And it certainly is far more linked, given the history of the last couple of months with the suicide attacks in nearby Volgograd, than, you know, say, the Boston Marathon bombings would be linked to any American athletic event. This is part of the story, and we have to cover it.
Michael, look across the Black Sea a little bit with us at Ukraine for a moment. There have been demonstrations there for weeks now against the deal the government there rejected with Europe, against their getting closer to Moscow, and a ever tougher crackdown this week, it appeared. What's going on in Ukraine, Michael?
Yeah, this is an existential struggle, really, for Ukraine's self-identity. Is it, you know, more part of Western Europe, which actually the western part of Ukraine, and this is geographically divided in terms of the protests in the Ukraine, they want to be part of the European Union, whereas, you know, the eastern more part of Ukraine tends to be friendlier toward Russia. And right now you have Viktor Yanukovych, a very Putin, Russia-friendly president in place, who reneged on a promise to begin negotiations with the EU and instead turned and faced Putin and embraced him, and Putin offered substantial aid because Ukraine is in a very serious financial crisis right now. And so you've had these violent protests in Kiev, really remarkable series of pictures of just how violent they were, people being set on fire, at least two deaths reported. And this is over really which way Ukraine is going to go, more toward Russia or more toward the European Union. And it's become a very complex picture because it's not just sort of Democrats demonstrating the streets. You've also got nationalist parties that are demonstrating against the Yanukovych government. So, you know, there are no real good guys here.
It's setting up to be an unusual Winter Olympic season with Ukraine next door and all of its troubles with the security threat in Sochi. We wish the athletes well there, but at the same time, we see maps on the news of those American warships in the Black Sea off of Sochi, prepared to evacuate people if necessary. I want to move to the president, if I may, and marijuana, his comments on that front this week. Jack, you've seen these. They're in print, and he's saying, marijuana, not more dangerous than alcohol, doesn't want his daughters using it, but acknowledging his own history with it, and a tone toward pot that I don't think we've ever heard from the White House before, Jack.
No, I think you're absolutely right. He does make, he does say, quote, bad habit and a vice. He does take a version of the slippery slope argument. He doesn't talk about marijuana as a gateway drug so much as about the legalization of marijuana as a gateway step. If we do that, will someone come along and say, well, what about cocaine? It's equivalent to a couple of glasses of vodka. Vodka is okay. He said, you know, so he was looking at a kind of slippery slope argument there. But on the other hand, he's saying, even talking about the experiments in Washington and Colorado, he says it's important for those experiments to go forward. So you won't have a situation in which a large portion of people have at one time or another broken the law and only a select few get punished. He comes back to that, to the idea that middle-class kids don't get locked up for smoking pot. Poor kids do. And the evidence that it's somehow dangerous is he doesn't see that there. Interestingly, USA Today, in their story, they quote a Donald Abrams, chief of oncology at San Francisco General Hospital. And he says, in my 37 years as a physician, the number of patients I've admitted to the hospital with complications from marijuana use is zero. The number I've admitted due to alcohol use is profound.
I mean, clearly there are big issues with alcohol use, but marijuana is what we've gone at more fiercely. What do you think, Stephanie? The president here getting real on marijuana or getting lazy on pot?
I think getting real. I mean, I read this as such an acknowledgement of generationally, really, where we all are in this country, where many people who've reached his age have have smoked marijuana at some point in their life. So to criminalize it, just it seems there is a kind of hypocrisy to it when it's something that really is kind of, you know, obviously Bill Clinton did it, Al Gore, you know, this whole generation of exactly of people who basically have acknowledged breaking the law. And it kind of makes you wonder, does the law make sense?
We did have this pushback from former Democratic congressman from Rhode Island, Patrick Kennedy, who was on MSNBC this week talking about the president's remarks that marijuana not being more dangerous than alcohol. Kennedy saying the president's view is out of date.
I think the president needs to speak to his NIH director in charge of drug abuse, Nora Volkow, because the NIDA director, Nora Volkow, would tell the president that, in fact, today's modern genetically modified marijuana, so it's much higher THC levels, far surpassed the marijuana the president acknowledges smoking when he was a young person.
And there it is. Maybe the marijuana is stronger these days. I don't know.
Maybe that's an argument for legalizing and regulating it.
Legalize and regulate. Though we've got listeners here writing online saying, hey, people are getting all excited about legalizing and taxing marijuana. Don't you know everybody can grow it? How do you tax it if everybody grows it? Annie in Iowa City. Annie, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. I was just calling because I support the comments that President Obama made. I'm a family and child therapist, and I have never seen marijuana tear a family apart. I've seen alcohol tear plenty of families apart. The only negative effect I've ever seen marijuana is in the criminalization of it and taking families away and the consequences that people have to deal with because of the criminalization.
That from a social worker, I mean, you know, you can find people who aren't happy about it as well when kids get on it, kids drive with it, when anybody drives with it. But point taken, Mike in Framingham, thank you, Annie. Mike in Framingham, Massachusetts. You're on, Mike.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. Hi. Listen, I'm a son of a father who was an abusive alcoholic. And ironically, he worked for Anheuser-Busch in St. Louis most of his adult life. Hmm. And I have to say, if my father had gotten high, I don't think the abuse and the horrible times my siblings and myself and my mother went through at that time. Saying that, I think that marijuana should be treated like alcohol. And there is an argument that it is a gateway drug. And I have to tell you, when you're a young man or a young woman as a child and you get high, which I did as a child, as a young man, I'll have to say the whole idea of getting high is to alter your state of mind to a certain degree. And sure. If somebody says, well, you like that altering state of mind, you should try this. And I'll have to say, I tried this. And I think when you're younger, you're more susceptible to the gateway argument, as opposed to when you're older, you tend to be a little more conservative-minded and less likely to take that jump. But I think, you know, like I said, the only downside to pot is that you know, anything your lung inhales besides air isn't good for you. So there's
True enough there, Mike. And we hear your point that you wish your father perhaps had been on that path rather than what took him to violence. But still, risks here. At the same time, we acknowledge them with alcohol. You'd have to acknowledge them with pot at some level. From right here in New Orleans, Pax is calling. Pax, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I personally have never used pot. But I seem to be a rare bird in that. It seems as though just about every adult I know has tried it. And aside from a few who have some addictive personality, they all seem to be fully functional, whereas alcohol has a great negative capacity for human health, as we know. And it's been in production and being sold and profits being made from it for thousands and thousands of years. And pot seems to be a newer drug that also has a cultural situation where it was associated with the African American population in our country, and there's this kind of
that's getting pretty far back now, Pax. I mean, it was associated with an awful lot of white hippies and everything else for a while as well. I mean, I get your historical perspective there. A lot has come up to date here. Michael, how do you read? Thank you, Pax. Michael, how do you read the president even getting into this? He didn't have to.
No, he didn't. And, you know, Republicans are already seizing on his comments as evidence of permissiveness. It's interesting to see marijuana, of all subjects, becoming potentially another, you know, political wedge issue between Democrats and Republicans, you know, heading into 2014 as the issue of legalization gets hotter. And, you know, I think the president was being very forthright in his comments to David Remnick of The New Yorker. Very careful in what he said. But frankly, his statement that he thought it was less dangerous than alcohol is somewhat controversial. I think is going to, you know, is going to cost the Democrats a little political pain.
Hey, Stephanie, you know, our time is almost out here. I don't want to get off without mentioning this Oxfam report. They've looked globally now and say, you know, 85 individuals have wealth collectively equivalent to that of 3.5 billion of the poorest on this planet. Inequality has been a big theme in this country. The president has hit it hard. Now here it is globally. They say, watch out. It's not just inequality. It translates into political power, a very different weight. Resonant issue going forward?
I think so. And you see it in issues like whether the state, for example, should accept the Medicaid expansion as part of the Affordable Care Act, which the governor does not want to do, Republican governor. But there's some feeling that even in a pretty conservative place, the reality is that people really need access to this.
It's a local issue. It's a national issue. With Oxfam's report this week, it is a startlingly global issue with some kind of ratio there. 85 to 3.5 million. That is kind of incredible. Stephanie Grace with The Advocate here in New Orleans. Wonderful to have you with us today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Michael Hirsch with National Journal in Washington. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Tom.
And Jack Beattie in Boston, thanks so much for joining us, Jack.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook from New Orleans. This is On Point.